Welcome to the Floor Tracing Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:06 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is July 14th, and going to kick off with Italy because Mario Draghi went and tendered his resignation to the president of Italy today, and they told him no. So the government did not fall, but the spread of Italian debt over bonds was up another 12 basis points and continues to trend higher. So the government crisis that you have in Italy hasn't just gone away. But we are in the middle of the summer, and not much happens in Italy during the summer. So it's unlikely that there's going to be an imminent election. And the Italian stock market has pulled back down into the underlying range. Now, if we look at this over more than a decade, we can see that it looked like a base formation completion back in 2021, and then we had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend in March. So this is a failed upside break. The dynamic of the failure was larger than the dynamic of the breakout. Therefore, we would have to conclude that the more likely scenario is that we're going to see this index come all the way down towards about 15,000. And of course, it's not going to do it all in one go. Then a lot of the Italian banks, or at least Italian banks, represent a large weighting within the Euro Stoxx Banks Index. And that's on a new low, or certainly a new closing low. So again, we had a really quite impressive rebound in 2021. And it broke back above the 1,000-day moving average and broke this medium-term downtrend from peaks back in 2014. But now it's also rolling over. And of course, then we have the euro, and it got all the way down to test the $1 level in here today, and at least steadied. But there's no evidence of an upward dynamic. Now, the ECB is going to start raising rates, but they're going to be exceptionally tentative about doing so. You have Deutsche Bank today talking about Germany moving into a recession. You already have countries in Europe that have two negative quarters of growth. There's the clear scope that we're going to see this energy crisis roll over into an economic crisis for Europe. And arguably, it's already there, but we're still in the middle of the summer. And when the winter comes and they start running out of gas, well, things are going to start getting desperate pretty quickly. And of course, that's what Russia is betting on. There's just no other way of describing it other than as a dastardly plan. But when we think about the speculation about whether they're going to allow the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to open back up again, well, you just have to think, why would they do that? Why would they give Europe an opportunity to refill their storage facilities? That would allow them to be better able to survive the winter. The thing that Russia needs more than anything else is for the unanimity of support within NATO and Europe for Ukraine to start to disintegrate. And certainly having a lot of people cold in the winter would certainly help with that. So the euro is certainly short-term oversold, and we could easily see some pause and consolidation here. The market was, I think, happy to price in the scope for a 100 basis point hike by the Federal Reserve yesterday. You had some statements by Fed officials in here today talking about a 75 basis point hike. 75 basis points sounded like a lot a month ago. Now it doesn't sound, it almost sounds reasonable. This is really quite acute tightening. And we still have these really deeply inverted yield curves. So the 10-year minus the 2-year was a little bit tighter in here today, or excuse me, a little bit wider in here today, but still at negative 17 basis points. And then we can think about the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month, which had been highlighted as an example of liquid financial conditions by Jay Powell as recently as March. But it has contracted exceptionally quickly over the course of the last few weeks. And it was also a little steadier in here today, but certainly not in the dynamic manner. Then we had oil prices, which had broken down earlier today, but then recouped most of the loss and then finished in positive territory. Still closing out the day below $100, but this is well off the lows. So demonstrating at least near-term support around this $100 area. Gasoline prices are also starting to come back down, and the futures have experienced the biggest pullback we've seen in a while, but also unwinding the overbought condition relative to the 200-day moving average. So it's a natural area where we might anticipate some support starting to come back in, despite the fact that prices have gone up so incredibly quickly over the course of this year. Now, when we think about the Nasdaq, I've posted a slide deck from Sequoia in here today. And they've been warning their partner companies to tighten their belts since May. They did exactly the same thing in February of 2020. They sent out similar memos in 2008 and then also in 2000. So they have a good history of anticipating economic trouble. And there is scope for economic trouble, but the Nasdaq's already pulled back by about 5,000 points. So it's priced in at least some bad news. And it's in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So you're going to have at least some people that want to buy the dip. And in a secular bull market, buying the dip works. But it usually coincides with central banks starting to ease up on their tightening, and there is just really no evidence that that's on the cards right now. Now, when we look at jobless claims, the Federal Reserve has two mandates. The first is to control inflation, and the other is to try and achieve full employment. So prior to the pandemic, we have lots of back history, and we can see that it's usually when we start getting up towards 500,000 people losing their jobs at any one time, or even in 2008. This peak was in March of 2009. The stock market bottomed in March of 2009. So this is obviously a very clear coincidence, where the stock market tends to bottom when joblessness peaks. So obviously then we had this extraordinary move in 2020, and it almost behooves us just not to look at it because it's such a skew. So we can just look at the fact that joblessness is rising. So I think that's the most important point. People are talking about this red hot employment market and that there are still lots of jobs available. But the number of people who are unemployed is rising. It bottomed in March. It's been trending higher. We're up to about 200, just about 250,000 people. And historically, it's when it peaks. That's usually when we get a significant load. We're just not there yet. Now we can think about what we saw today from bank earnings. So JP Morgan came out with earnings this morning, and the stock gapped lower. So they're seeing that their business is stalling. They're obviously having difficulty with an inverted yield curve and very high mortgage rates. And they fired over 1,000 mortgage bankers in the last month. So they've already been cutting headcount. And these types of story aren't being reported as much. Instead, what we're hearing a lot about is the job openings by industry, the jobs report. And there's still a clear concentration on the fact that there are millions of jobs available. But I do wonder how accurate that is. So, what kind of jobs are available? And as we have more people out of work, is there such an incredibly large mismatch in the economy? That kind of mismatch is obviously going to be eroded over time. There will be either companies will be unable to find workers, or they're going to have to start training programs to train workers that they can find to do the jobs. And this was something that apprenticeship programs were very common in the 1970s. But of course, then if we have an economic contraction, you don't need quite as many people. A lot of these open job positions might disappear, and they could disappear in a very short period of time. So, certainly in companies that I am familiar with and people and where I know people, well, I've seen quite a few businesses where they were growth oriented and they were anticipating jumping up in terms of how many people they employed. Until really about March of this year. And it's only really in the last month I've seen people getting fired. So the old adage is that when your friends get fired, it's a recession. And when you lose your job, it's a depression. And there's this big argument right now about whether this is a recession or not, or whether it's coming or when it's going to come. But we have high energy prices. We have central banks that are raising rates and also contracting the size of their balance sheets. And the total assets of central banks have contracted by about 3 trillion over the course of this year so far. So this is a really phenomenally large pullback in the size of total assets on central bank balance sheets. And these kinds of moves tend to be deflationary. So we've had the inflation as a result of this massive monetary accommodation. Now, with this accommodation being removed, then there's the potential that what we're in fact looking at is the threat of deflation. But it's going to take a while. It will not be accompanied, it won't happen on its own, will be accompanied, I should say, by unemployment and by lower industrial demand. We're certainly looking at that potential outcome in Germany, for example. And the DAX index is still right in the region of the low from back in March and earlier this month, but it's a clear downtrend. Now, China is starting to talk about a $1 trillion stimulus package. But what I thought was interesting is the stock market hasn't been especially enthused by the news. There's a couple of writers on the program, and most particularly, it's about not having off-balance sheet debt. And one thing that we know for certain is that China is a massive consumer of copper and it occupies about 50% of the market. So, if China is in fact going to spend all that money on infrastructure, then it's going to represent a jump in demand for the for copper prices. And we might have a short-term oversold condition, but there isn't really a lot of evidence yet that demand for copper is returning in a big way. And we're definitely also seeing that industrial metals are rolling over, agricultural products are rolling over. So the Invesco Agriculture Futures Fund has broken its uptrend and is really now trending downwards. Coffee prices, which had been really resurgent, broke below the 200-day moving average in here today and did so in really quite a dynamic manner. So that's a peak of at least near-term and potentially medium-term significance. When we think about the Brazilian real, it's been among the firmest, but it has pulled back really quite acutely over the last 6 weeks. So coming back into the 550 area versus the US dollar. And this is around where, if it's going to find support, then it should start to happen around these levels. When we think about the IPOs that have come to market in the last year, we've had a really quite acute decline. And the ETF was down again in here today, despite the fact the NASDAQ was finishing out the day in positive territory. The IPO ETF has unwound most of the advance in 2020. And one would have to, I think it's now time to be a bit more discerning about the outlook for the technology sector. One of the companies in that Sequoia report that they highlighted for strong revenue growth and their capacity for improving free cash flow was ServiceNow. And the share has been pulling back, and it was down in a dynamic manner over the course of this week. When we look at their just the bare fundamentals, the free cash flow has risen from 586 million to nearly 2 billion over the course of the last 5 years. And that's on revenue of about 6 billion. So that's really quite impressive. And the market cap over is rather high, but it's also quite a bit below where it was at the end of 2021. So we're in a position now where there's definitely these kinds of companies that are capable of growing their free cash flow. Well, they're going to survive. And they might even prosper if they can go ahead and capture market share. So the big argument for Square, or I guess it's now called Block, was that it would be able to eat PayPal's dinner. But it's not quite as profitable, but it is a profitable company. So it does look likely that PayPal and Block will be duking it out for the fintech sector, and then the rest of the companies that don't have revenues or don't have a runway for growth, they'll probably cease to exist. And I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see a distilling of the technology sector. The companies that have successfully got profits and reorient themselves to the new reality of less available liquidity and at a higher price, then they will continue to prosper. But the rest of the sector that fails to achieve those metrics won't. And that's just what we get in bear markets. The winners start to exhibit relative strength early, and the losers don't. And I think this is the thing that we need to keep an eye on now within the technology sector. It's for the companies that have got profits and they have a sufficiently wide margin of cash that they'll be able to weather a storm. And a storm is coming. Federal Reserve is still raising rates. Whether they raise by 75 basis points or 1,000 basis points, or excuse me, 100 basis points this month is kind of beside the point. They're still raising faster than everyone else. So then you have China promising to spend $1 trillion, but the market's not reacting in as impressive a manner as one might anticipate. If they do go ahead and start spending that kind of money, it will have a transformative effect on some of the industrial resources. But they're not bouncing just yet. They might yet bounce, and they are oversold, but not really bouncing just yet. Australia's market is off the lows put in June, but hasn't rebounded in as emphatic a fashion as would be required to really instill confidence. We're still right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, so it's a natural area where we see some steadier action, but it's got a lot of work to do to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So I do think that it's still quite a risky environment, but we do have short-term oversold conditions. So it's likely then that we get a little bit of a pause and consolidation. But when we think about how lows really form, it's when liquidity conditions improve, and that's not quite happening yet. Now, gold prices got down to test the $1,700 level again in here today. They closed off the low, but I think there's a very strong correlation between the ruble and oil and gold. And on the days when oil weakens, gold sells off more. So gold's not as big a market as oil. And when oil prices falter, then the ruble tends to also weaken. And then gold starts to sell off. So we had another volatile day on the ruble as well in here today. And I think that we have some evidence at this stage that it's the Russian government is letting go of some of their gold to try and support the value of the ruble. And that suggests that there is a very strong link now between the oil price and gold. So a very strong positive correlation. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.